We are about to chat with a Georgia foster mom about the abuse of power we are continuing to witness around the country. Join us today on Fostering the Future.
Welcome to the Fostering the Future podcast, a show about all things child welfare, dependency, adoption, and foster care. Here are your hosts, veterans in the world of child welfare, Jack and Kat.
We believe that every human has incredible and equal value regardless of what side of the courtroom we sit on. We hope that everyone feels welcome and accepted here on Fostering the Future.
Make sure you follow us on Facebook or Instagram as Fostering the Future Podcast, or check us out on our website at fosteringthefuturepodcast.org. This is Jack, and my good friend Christy is riding shotgun today. Welcome, Christy. Can you share a little bit about yourself?
Thank you. I would say that my identity for many, many years was as someone who worked in foster care, but I prefer to show up in spaces like these more as a parent advocate and as an advocate for racial justice. What I realized in that work is that it felt more powerful to put down any titles or what my experience was and really just come as Christy, the concerned community member who is fiercely passionate about protecting families and about racial justice.
That rings really true to our value statement and kind of made me smile when you said that. But we need to initiate you, Christy, because this is your first time co-hosting. And I need you to tell me what your favorite item is at Starbucks.
Oh, my favorite item would be a cake pop. But if we're talking coffee, I'm not really a coffee drinker. I'm a Coke drinker, which is terrible.
And you can't get that at Starbucks.
No. So when I go to Starbucks, I get like a caramel frappe with no coffee.
Do you have a particular cake pop you like? My kids love the cake pops.
I like the birthday cake ones. My nephew works at Starbucks. So when I was actually in Georgia, you know, when they're ready to throw them away, like they can bring this stuff home. He bought me these two boxes of cake pops. I have like 52 cake pops.
Oh my gosh, stop. Well, the thing I like about the birthday cake pop is that they're not chocolate and they're not messy. So when I have like a kid in my car who will get messy in my car, a cake pop, when I stroll on by to get my chai, is the way to make them happy. So thank you for sharing with us, Christy. Today, we also have Jennifer with us, who is a Georgia foster mom, who is going to share with us about her experience with the Hernandez family. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
What is your favorite beverage at Starbucks?
I don't know if I've been to Starbucks in 10 years. If I'm going to go out and about and get an iced coffee, it's going to be from Dunkin' Donuts or at home. I love iced coffee at home.
And how do you make your coffee?
Just good coffee, sometimes chicory blend, but good creamer. I like some vanilla creamer.
So Jen, I had first heard about your story from the Parents Behind the Pinwheels TikTok last year. I was really excited to have you here and hear about what had happened.
You know, I always kind of feel weird doing any interview or talking to anyone about this because I like to think of myself genuinely as a happy person. But when you're talking about this kind of stuff, it's, you know, it is tough.
Can you start by telling us a little bit about how you got into child welfare, your interest in becoming a foster parent?
So when I was growing up, I actually was born and raised in Florida. My parents did foster care. I loved it a lot. We didn't have a lot of kids coming and going because we soon, after getting some boys into our home, they became available for adoption. So we didn't do a lot of foster care, but I loved the idea of one day not having kids and the next day having kids. It was just, I don't know, it was exciting for me as a kid. They felt like my brothers. I had a biological sister, but they felt the exact same to me. And as I grew older, I just knew two things in my head. I wanted to homeschool any future children I had, and I wanted to do foster care, possibly adoption. And that was just something I really wanted to do. And when I started dating my now husband, that was just something I brought up. You know, I want to do foster care. And if you're not okay with that, this isn't going to work. if you're okay with that, then we can keep dating. And thankfully, he was great with it. We've been married 16 years, and I wasn't even sure if I wanted biological children. That was not something I felt I needed to have. We did end up having a child, and when she was 4 months old, we started our foster care classes, our impact training, and wanted specifically to adopt. Once our adoption was complete, we decided to open our home to foster care in the hopes of just fostering and reunifying families. It's not something I thought about as a child, but once I became an adult, I realized how important that was, that you could be part of the safe part, helping kids get back to their parents and kind of being a cheerleader and mentoring. I never thought about that as a kid, of course, but it was so neat to me to think about being part of that. So I really just wanted to do foster care. My husband was good with it. Such a neat thing to be able to help reunify families.
So you had been able to find online the story from the parents. Can you share that with our listeners who don't really know what happened with the Hernandez family?
So husband, wife, married 11 years. They have a three-year-old. They have a brand new baby. Baby does well. The baby sleeps well. The baby's a great baby. They noticed her leg, her right leg, her thigh was swollen. She's about 12 weeks old at this time. They can see it's swollen. On that same day, the mom is noticing to her, the baby's skull looks swollen. So dad's at work. So Taki sends a message to her husband. You know, I'm looking at, and I feel like I'm looking at swollen leg, swollen skull, but Emma's not crying. She seems content. The dad says, well, tomorrow we have a follow-up appointment with Aria, which is their oldest, at the pediatrician. Let's call them and see if they can also see Emma. That's what they do. So the next day they go to their pediatrician. They say, you know, look at her leg. Look at her skull. The doctor looks at her skull and says, oh, there's nothing wrong with her head. So we can touch on that later. But that was the pediatrician. However, yes, I do see there's a swollen in her right leg. Has anything else been going on? Well, the parents, the dad says, yeah, I've got a photo of what looked like a leg bruise on the back of Emma's ear. I took a picture of it a few days ago. It went away within 2 days. We were just going to watch it. And I've seen the photo, and it's definitely this something I would have done. It's like a spot, and you can't really tell, like, did she lean on a car seat? So they took a picture, showed it to this pediatrician. I'm not sure what was said at that time, but later that becomes a very big deal. However, the parents were just trying to watch that. From there, their pediatrician says, you need to go to Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, and we need to get your baby x-rayed. So they say, okay, let's go right now. Children's Healthcare of Atlanta is the biggest and the best hospital that most pediatricians would want to go. So they send the family there. Their parents also ask for full blood work. Like, while you're doing x-rays, can we just get a full blood work going? Let's find out what's going on. Well, they do an x-ray and they come back and tell the parents that there are multiple ribs that have fractures that are in different healing stages. And there's a fracture on this baby's leg. So it's immediate. It's someone's hurt this baby. Which one of you hurt this baby? And from there, it was just an interrogation. They separated the mom and dad. Because Taki was a stay-at-home mom and had the baby more often, of course, while dad is at work, that's why she got arrested first. When you hear abused baby, I think we all do like a mental picture, right? I've done that before. The news puts an abused baby is left. Horrible pictures go through your mind. So I've seen the pictures of Emma in the hospital at this time. And what I want people to understand is you had a very happy, content baby with no bruising on her body at this time. The spot behind her ear was completely changed. The color was back to normal. There are no bruises. There's only swelling on her leg. That's it. So the hospital actually wraps her in a soft splint, like an ACE bandage. They wrap her leg in that and they give her children's Tylenol. So I don't want people to think this is like a battered, beaten, bruised baby like our mind may go to. Within 2 hours, it's get family here. Your baby is going into state custody. They allowed the maternal aunt and uncle to take Emma and Aria home.
You said 2 hours from the time they got to the hospital.
Yeah, within 2 hours, this is abuse. So no tests have been run on Emma. No background. Now, in reports, they claim that questions were asked. The thing is, mom was born in Thailand. She didn't see a doctor growing up. She wasn't even born in a hospital. She doesn't have a lot of medical documents, but it's been recorded that during the interrogation, mom said, everything's good. I'm always been healthy. So just little things like that, that aren't accurate. The parents were separated while interrogated. Aunt and uncle came, took both girls home. They were told from that point on, only visits supervised for mom and dad. So the aunt and uncle were able to get breast milk from the mom so that she could continue feeding Emma. And that's how it went for a couple of weeks until Taki was arrested, where the police showed up at her home and arrested her. We've been to every court hearing since that point. I'm not going to just jump on some bandwagon. I want to keep kids safe, too. That's my number one goal. I'm never going to fight for kids to go back home to a bad situation. And even if I'm not a detective, if I'm not a doctor, I'm a human with a brain, with a heart. I know how to ask questions. I know how to look at the big picture. So our goal at that point was try and get to know the family and see if we can kind of help them through the foster parent side and what they can do to get their kids back. This wasn't from the beginning claiming innocence because I didn't know. All I knew was things weren't going the right way. I knew that keeping a baby from its mother is wrong, especially when you have supervised visits that are available. Keeping a three-year-old from her mom is very confusing and very traumatizing. So those were the things that we were concerned with. It was not just screaming innocence for the parents. Once mom was arrested, there was no more contact between her and her children. So dad was having visits at that point twice a week. Emma woke up one day. Aria noticed, what's wrong with Emma's foot? And they looked and they took her little sleeper and she had discoloration on her leg. Bluish purple discoloration going on her leg. And they thought, oh no. They called DFACS as a good people trying to do everything they were supposed to do. DFACS said, oh, you need to take her back to CHOA. So the aunt and uncle take her back to CHOA because they're trying to listen to DFACS. And one caseworker makes the comment, I wonder if the aunt and uncle let the mom over against bond and they let her abuse this baby. And they ran with that story with one caseworker making this abstract comment, which is insane. Not that there's not bad people out there. But child abuse isn't contagious. I mean, it's silly to even hear that. Okay. Even though we know there's bad people in this world, if you can meet people and you do background checks and you see what kind of people they are, it's absolutely utterly ridiculous. So they were immediately taken from the aunt and uncle at that point. And they had other family, fictive kin, and other relatives in other states. DFACS wouldn't hear anything of it. They would not consider calling anyone. They weren't willing to look into family in other states. It just was out of the question for them. So at that point, dad just continued having visits. And that's about the time we came to the picture.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
So you fast forward into our life. We have five beautiful children. We had closed for a short time after our adoption to our two oldest. We wanted to just kind of take that time to be a family. Once they moved out and were on their own, we decided we would open our home up again. At that time, we wanted to do respite, you know, just short-term placement while they're either waiting for a home to open up, or if they're full-time foster parent, maybe traveling and unable to bring the kids with them. So this was last summer of 2023. We got a call about two little girls. At the time, they were 3 and almost 4 months. I've gotten to a place when they're younger, I don't ask a lot of questions. If they're a little bit older, I want to know more to prepare my kids, to prepare my home, make sure it's something we can handle. When they're younger, I don't typically ask, certainly no nosy questions. It's not my business why they're in care. I just like to know what I need to know. There was nothing regarding the girls' information once they came. I didn't have last name. I didn't have that information. They came kind of in the evening time. The next day is when we really started noticing things with Emma. Beautiful baby. She was about 4 months, but there were just things about her that I thought were odd, medically possibly. You know, she held her little joints, her arms and her legs. She was a little bow-legged. She would hold her arms just kind of odd, like in awkward positions, and I would kind of move them for her. And I started asking my husband, like, do you think she sits like on my lap weird? Like, she looks off to me. And when I gave her a bath, I noticed her skull because she has really dark, beautiful hair, silky hair. And I noticed when it was wet, her skull seemed sunken in and sloped. And I was like, well, that's odd. I wonder if there's anything medical going on and no one's told me. I reached out to the foster mom and let her know some of my concerns. The baby was also severely constipated while she was with us. The foster mom said, well, all the things you're noticing, that's abuse. Did nobody tell you that Emma recently was put into foster care because of abuse? Her parents hurt her. My first thought is, well, no one told me anything about that. But the things I'm seeing does not equal to abuse. That just didn't make sense to me. So I just kind of brushed it off. When they left our home, I sent a letter to the case manager, like I normally would, just to let them know how the time was. Girls were great. Here are my concerns for the baby. And the response from her was, oh, thank you so much for your insight, because we're looking into medical evaluations to find out what's going on with Emma. And I was like, well, that's completely different than, you know, what the foster mom said. So at that point, I actually looked them up online, which normally I would do anyway. We live in a very small town. So if they're anywhere from around here, I like to know whose kids I have. It's not me being nosy. It's me trying to understand more, because the department doesn't always give you that information. Well, as soon as I did a search on them, I could not believe what I was seeing. It took me aback, because the mom was pleading out for help for her baby. She was saying, there's something wrong with my baby. I went to the doctor to get help. And instead of help, I've been arrested. My kids are in foster care. You know, she went through this whole thing and my heart just kind of dropped. And I immediately felt connected with her. I immediately felt like everything I was reading was truth. There was nothing that I was reading where I thought, oh, I can't believe this mom's getting on here, you know, and pouring her whole life out. It just felt like truth to me. So I talked to my husband and we both agreed I wanted to call her. She put her phone number out there. If anyone knows of how I can get help, this is August of 2023. At that time, she had a bond order where she could not speak to her husband nor see her children. That was another thing that was off to me, because the foster mom said, oh, it's such a sad situation. The mom doesn't even come to visits. And I thought, gosh, that is sad, because usually the parents go to visits. So when I'm reading this, I'm like, well, the mom didn't go to visits because she's not allowed. And I immediately thought, why is she not allowed? Like, we've had kids in our home, as I'm sure you guys have, where there's obvious abuse and they're getting visits with their parents.
I had a kid come to my house. He was covered head to toe in bruises, like fingerprint marks around the neck. And also, like, anytime anybody moved, he would like flinch immediately, visits the whole time. To me, that meant kids get visits regardless. We find a way to make them safe, but kids get visits. And also, that was the same with the Maya Kowalski case. The mom was completely deprived visits. And that's not normal, especially in these situations where the abuse itself is questionable.
Absolutely. Plus, this was a breastfeeding baby. Just reading her story and so many things being in foster care for so many years, things were not adding up to me. So I thought, well, there's just something off about this situation. Why in the world is this mom not having visits with her kids? Because visits are by third party. Visits have someone supervising. They have cameras. So yes, like you said, you can make the situation very safe for these children to keep that bond with their parents. Because regardless of what's going on, we're supposed to be looking at the children. What is the bond for them with their caregivers? That was another thing. She was breastfeeding. And in this story, it was, I've been pumping my milk. I've been delivering it to DFACS for my baby, yet we had no breast milk given to us. So that was a red flag for me, because when she wrote this was just a couple weeks later. And I'm like, well, no one gave me breast milk. I only had formula. And this baby's severely constipated. I was given extra iron drops to give the baby. This formula was like high in iron, like written on the front. And I thought, well, my gosh, this is a problem. So while we were kind of going slowly into giving our concerns to the department, I realized we were getting a little bit of pushback. And that's where the concerns only strengthened from there, is things were not adding up, because no matter what, reunification is supposed to be the goal. I mean, if people don't know that, that's the goal. You want reunification when possible. If we went to the adjudication, parents, what's the next step? Family, blood relatives, that's the next step. Well, that was also going on. There were blood relatives requesting to get placement of the girls, and it was being denied. They wanted to hire attorneys because they could see that that's what they needed to do. And now at that point, Taki is no longer allowed to see her children, talk to her children, see her husband or her sister or brother-in-law. So her sister came from Thailand with Taki. They came from Thailand together to become au pairs in America.
What is the explanation for her not being able to have communication with her husband or sister and brother-in-law?
There's no answer that I have heard except for this happens in Forsyth County. That's the only answer we've been given. So Forsyth County can do this. They look at it like a witness list, and they don't want you conspiring with other witnesses.
Like, how long did that go on?
Matt and Taki just got their bond order modified last Wednesday. So 4 days ago. So for 10 months, almost 10 months, she could not speak to her husband via text, social media. I mean, lawyers even told us, don't even put them in the same social media post because that can look bad. So they had no communication whatsoever. Some of the irony in this is some of the things they had to do for DFACS to get their kids back is make future goals, future plans of what are you going to do to get your kids back? Like, how are you supposed to do that when you can't communicate with each other, right?
You're setting them up to fail.
Definitely. Now, Matt ended up finding out Taki had a bond condition hearing in December of 2023, hoping to modify so she could talk to her husband again. We were present for that hearing as well. The state announced at that hearing, Your Honor, there's really no reason for you to remove this bond condition because we are going to indict both Mr. and Mrs. Hernandez through a grand jury on Monday. This was a Thursday. It was a sit-in judge. The judge was not there that day, so it was a sit-in judge. Y'all, this judge was so confused at why this mom had gone 7 months without seeing her babies. Like, this poor man, he was elderly and he was so confused. He was like, I don't understand why this mom hasn't seen her kids. Aren't the visits supervised? Yes, Your Honor. Aren't there cameras? Yes, Your Honor, there are. He was like, then why has this mom not seen her children? Her breastfeeding baby, her three-year-old who asks for her daily. It was really sad. And on that day, he did grant that the mom could do visits. So she was able to start visits a few days later, but she did not get to talk to Matt at that time. And their 12-year wedding anniversary was coming up and they missed that. They missed Christmas. They missed both girls' birthdays. They missed Thanksgiving. They missed so much because of this stupid situation, especially the no contact.
Was it a combination of defects and law enforcement, or do you think this was mainly driven by DFACS? Is that particular agency, are they known for doing things like this?
Well, to begin with, the child abuse pediatrician is definitely at fault here. They are a hammer and everything they see is a nail. And they just go around smashing nails everywhere without thinking. Emma was also discharged from the hospital, you guys, during that first time being brought there with a low vitamin D, very low. So they put her on a high dose of vitamin D. Well, I mean, is that correspondent with abuse? No, of course it's not. So why not go from there and look at mom's vitamin D levels? Let's check that. It took months, but finally, because you get blocked from some of your medical records. So these parents are getting blocked from viewing their own medical records for their baby. And we found out later that Taki also was low in vitamin D when she was pregnant, when she had Emma. You said, who's at fault? So child abuse pediatrician, definitely. They have so much power for I don't know what reason. DFACS even sat down and had a meeting with me and my husband. We requested one. We had a meeting with multiple directors, regional directors, county directors. One of them even said, you know, sometimes when a child abuse pediatrician says abuse, there's nothing we can even do. And I just don't believe that garbage at all. There's always something we can do. We do not have to just sign our name on the dotted line and just start ripping kids out of homes and handing out case plans, which in the state of Georgia, you're supposed to give the parents a case plan within 30 days. Okay. That's a federal law to give parents a case plan. It took 120 days before the parents even saw a case plan. But no one seems bothered by that at all. That's a huge deal to me. By the time they saw it, you guys, at the adjudication hearing, DFACS was already asking to terminate parental rights. That's crazy. That's insane to already be asking to terminate. So law enforcement definitely messed up. Someone signed a paper. Everybody underneath that just looked at it and was like, oh, it's abuse. Oh, it's more kids abuse. And they just go with it. Nobody stops to like turn their head on and think about this logically or to sit down and meet the parents. I mean, you're talking about guardian ad litems, CASA, multiple caseworkers, multiple law enforcement. Everybody is just signing their name and doing their part. Nobody is stopping to look at this. So I think that's the biggest problem. You have definitely the leader is child abuse pediatricians. You mentioned earlier, Jack, all of the parents behind the pinwheels. People need to go in there and see there's not a single one of those stories that does not have a child abuse pediatrician involved. Now, you might have some caseworkers being bad actors, but you have some trying to save the day. You have some who do try and step in, good CASAs that try and step in. These child abuse pediatricians say abuse and everybody just falls into line as if there's no other possible explanation.
It's hard for me to wrap my head around that, but there's a case here in Florida that I'm familiar with. You have all these other doctors that have given an opinion, but they are hung up on this, we call them here CPT, Child Protection Team. It just seems like across the nation, these physicians and these hospital workers have so much power. It doesn't make sense. Systems will never change themselves. They have no desire to self-correct. They have no desire to admit when they're wrong. They're doing exactly what they were designed to do, which is take children from their families. I've heard you say in different interviews about reunification, like I was just doing what DFACS says their goal is, which is reunification. And yeah. I recently looked at stats here in Florida about reunification, about just that. We say that the goal is reunification, but is it really?
Right.
In Florida, the reunification of the children who went home last year, only about 40% of those children were reunified. We're lying to ourselves by telling ourselves that the goal is reunification. When year after year of the children you're sending home, only 40% are going to their parents.
You know, DFACS had a meeting with us, but before that, they closed our home. They shut our home down. I'm not a foster parent anymore. And when you ask why, they state their reason is they no longer think we have the same goals as they do. Those are their words, not mine. So when that happened, I said, well, our goals are to keep kids safe and to reunify them with their parents. So maybe we don't have the same goals anymore. Honestly, they admitted to that because they closed our home. They allowed us to have the meeting. We're not looking to reopen our home, obviously, at this point. I don't want to do something where I'm not trusted. We were really careful with how we were raising our concerns. We weren't screaming from the rooftops. We weren't saying mean things. We were showing facts and saying, hey, guys, we want to reunify a family. So why at an adjudication hearing did I hear a caseworker sit in front of me during a break? She had a mentor who was watching court that day. She literally told that girl, well, this is basically a done deal. We've already written up TPR paperwork, so this will be over real quick. She said it with a smug smile on her face. She's been evil and corrupt from day one, this specific caseworker. And in fact, she's the only one who showed up to court. The actual caseworkers didn't even show up to court. This one did. And then she took over the case. They are not trying to reunify. Even if a parent is guilty, and I know both of you women will agree with me, even if someone is guilty of abuse, whether it's physical, neglect, we do not go around ripping children from homes and then taking them and not giving parents the chance. That's disgusting. These are their children. If they are in harm's way, then we need to step in and help. And there are ways to do that. But that is not what is being done with this case or several of the other cases that I'm now actively trying to advocate for. It's the same situation. This child abuse pediatrician, he did not bring any documentation with him. He brought no paperwork. He brought no x-rays. He said the injuries Emma sustained are 95% of the time abuse. And when the defense attorney said, well, what about the other 5%? And where do you get these statistics? His answer was, you can look it up on the internet. What about that 5%? He claimed that they did the OI test. You guys, there's like 64 genes you have to test for osteogenesis imperfecta. Children's Healthcare of Atlanta ran two. That is not running a test. They told the parents, they told court, we've done every test. We've done everything we can. This is not factual. They are now wanting to run a gene test on Emma. The state has decided they want to do this. They're picking a sister hospital to CHOA. So the parents, thankfully, in January, this started in June, finally have the opportunity now and the blessings of the court to get a second opinion on their baby. So they can now run tests. But guess who makes the appointments? And guess how fast and helpful the department has been with that?
And guess what background information they're going to provide? And guess what the assumptions right off the bat are going to be?
I've already seen those emails, Jack. So you're exactly right. That's exactly what's happening. So you get excited at a hearing to hear a judge say, you now can test your baby. This judge did deny termination of parental rights, thankfully. So they are on a reunification plan, which is awesome. And that is, we are very thankful for that opportunity. But the girls need to be with family. A family friend stepped in when the girls were asked to leave their other foster home. These poor girls have been through multiple foster homes, not just mine. We were just one respite.
So when they left your house, did they go back to the foster parent they were previously at?
Exactly. They did. And they were with her from July until December. And she put them in respite care almost every weekend. So many red flags, you guys, of just weird stuff that's happening. And being in that courtroom, I was not used to the evil and the rudeness and the sarcasm that I saw. That never happened in the courtrooms from our little rural town, Georgia, and even the other bordering counties where we would go for other kids. What you said earlier, Jack, about everybody in that courtroom deserves respect no matter what side you're on, that should be common knowledge. And I am telling you, I left that courthouse October 6, 2023, a broken person. I think we got home and I went to bed. It was like 6 o'clock at night. I woke up so empty. I woke up so broken of what I had just seen for a 3-day trial, because they tried to rip this family apart in front of me. They were sarcastic. This is the defects caseworker and the SAG, the defects attorney. They were so rude. They were so hateful. They treated these people so mean with no respect. I didn't understand it. I just didn't understand it. And it was after that, that our home got closed after I testified. And it felt like retaliation. And I had told my husband when we were leaving, I said, should we be afraid? Like, I don't know if I want to do this anymore. Now they've seen my face. They know me. I think we need to close our home. And we had talked about closing it. And that was our plan. We were going to close our home. We even put an email in. And after a couple of days went by, that woman was on vacation. I said, you know what? I want to call her. I want to explain to this individual where I'm at. I called her. We spoke 30 minutes. She said, Jennifer, Forsyth County beats to their own drum. She said, there's not really a blacklist, but you should be careful. I would not take any more kids from their county, but keep doing respite care. Keep doing what you're doing. You've been doing this 13 years. Keep going. Just take kids from other counties. Okay, you know, thank you so much for your time. When I hang up 2 days later, I get an email. Thank you for your time at DFACS. Like, goodbye. Take the exit survey. And I'm like, what? So I email her this time and she said, well, when I got off the phone with you, a few things I didn't like what you said. And it's like, why didn't you say that to me? We had an adult conversation. Why would you hang up the phone and then send me this random email? Why would you not say, Jennifer, I have concerns about what you're saying and doing. I'm adult enough to listen to that. No, she closed our home instead. To me, that only solidifies what you guys are doing.
And that they really don't have the same goals as you.
Yes, it makes you look really shady to do that. You shouldn't do that. You need to have open communication with us. You didn't like us speaking out. And that was before any interviews, you guys. I wasn't interviewing. I wasn't doing any of this. You know, I was just going to them, talking to them and witnessing, testifying on the parents' behalf of what I had seen. So just from there, everything is just snowballed out of control, in my opinion. Great news being that the parents now get to talk to each other. That is a beautiful thing. They cannot visit their children together yet. They're still visiting separate because DFACS, in their words, has to work on some paperwork before that can happen. They've not seen their mother and father in the same room, you guys, in 10 months.
I think what's so devastating when you see this is the amount of power that these organizations, these individuals wield, and how powerless you feel at times to be able to do anything to change the trajectory of where it's going. It's like, this is a runaway train. And it's like, it's so hard to like comprehend sometimes, like, who is going to stop this? Like, there has to be somebody. Everybody has a boss, right? But it's like, everybody protects everybody else, you know?
I guess we're naive in the beginning. Okay, let's get in touch with representatives. Let's talk to legislators. Oh my gosh, we should get in touch with our governor. Let's talk with Candace Bros, who's the DFACS commissioner. Let's just really let everyone know that this is happening and this is wrong. Nobody in Georgia cares. There is no oversight with DFACS. Every single legislator representatives will either like hear us out and say, oh, that's so sad. You know, there's nothing we can do about that. Or they'll say, oh, well, let us look into this. And you don't hear back from them. And DFACS will have a nice meeting with you. And then at the end, they'll say, unfortunately, we can't tell you guys anything about this case, you know, privacy reasons for the family. And I just laugh. Like, I mean, I know more about the case than they do.
That's what I was going to say, where you're in a situation where it's like, I don't need you to tell me anything. I'm here to tell you something.
Legitimately, that's what I said.
I literally had this conversation. I've had a situation where I had to go literally to the top of the chain of command in the multiple agencies. And was either told it's out of my hands, but you're the top. Whose hands are it in?
Whose hands do we need to get in touch with?
Whose are the right hands? Or to just walk away from a situation that it's handled when it clearly wasn't. And I was watching the Pinwheel TikTok last night, and my husband, who has a tendency of walking in and out of a room and not really know what's going on, but hear parts of things and making comments, he's walking through the room and he's like, ah. That sounds familiar. And then he said, I thought there's supposed to be checks and balances. For me, with all of these abusive power stories from Melissa Bright to Maya Kowalski to what's going on here with the Hernandez family to things that have happened locally, the whole idea of our government and our systems being fair is that there's supposed to be checks and balances, right? There's supposed to be agencies checking between each other and overseeing each other to make sure things like this don't happen. So what could be done to, in your opinion, to make more of a checks and balances system for DFACS?
We need to weed out the people who aren't there for the right reasons. Okay, so that's an internal thing, definitely. In this case in particular, because I've been asked that, well, Jennifer, we don't want to send kids home to an abusive situation. It's better to overreact than underreact. Wrong. It is not. Because you can destroy these people. Look where we are at 10 months later. This family is going to need so much therapy. They are struggling. They are terrified. They are on the verge of losing their family, right? They're $100,000 in debt with legal fees. That's not even criminal. So what could have been done in this situation? Emma gets brought in by two parents who willingly bring her in. You tell them, hey, we have some concerns. We found fractures, which actually, guys, are lesions. I just want to make that clear, too. These are not fractures. When you see like a broken leg in half, these are lesions at the top of her tibia and femur, and she has cupping on her ribs. So there's telltale signs of rickets, vitamin D deficiency. They should have looked at that. They should have said, we need to ask more questions. We need to check Emma's levels. We need to find out your levels. We do not want your kids going home with you because we're concerned. So we would like to put them with family. We would like to come to your home. Do a safety check. We would like to talk to your employers, your neighbors. It can be invasive, but I guarantee you this family would have 10 times picked that over than what they got handed to them. They would have much rather people talk to others and get references and do these tests. In October, they had two specialists, a forensic pathologist and a geneticist from Florida, who both gave multiple reasons of what's going on with Emma based off of her x-rays and her blood work to say, oh yeah, Vitamin D deficiency, she can definitely have lesions and fractures. It makes your bone more fragile. She was put on a vitamin D supplement by Choa. Why did they put her on that? Because she was low in vitamin D. But they don't want to talk about that. And the judge at that time didn't want to hear these other two medical expert witnesses given their testimony. I've listened to their testimony, you guys. I saw the x-rays and I saw their documents. The child abuse pediatrician, Emmanuel Pena, he came with nothing. He had no documentation. He brought nothing with him.
So I think in Texas, Melissa Bright had told us that she had worked together with other people who had so similar things happen where they created new legislation, actually, if you have a situation where a child abuse pediatrician is claiming abuse, that the medical board in the state has to consider any medical information that the family submits as well to determine whether it's child abuse or not, so that there is an overseeing board on these child abuse pediatricians where they're not just going into courtrooms and being the only voice that is heard. I think these judges think, oh, this guy's an expert in child abuse, but you're not considering in all of these stories, they're not an expert in CRPS. They're not an expert in
metabolic bone disease.
Right. In that they're not an expert in the actual disease that the children actually have. So when you have those experts come into the table and bring the reasons like why these child abuse pediatricians are being considered all over all other opinions, I think that's where we need more checks and balances over those doctors. There needs to be someone with a level head who isn't going in with a hammer looking to turn everything into a nail. And that needs to be nationwide, not just in Texas.
In Texas, that's the second opinion law, and that just got passed in 2021. Wouldn't you have thought that was already a thing, though? That's where my brain is at. I don't know why we need a law to let parents get a second opinion. Because if I go in with my child to a dentist and they say, well, she needs braces, I mean, I feel like I can go to another dentist and say, do you think my child needs braces? You should be allowed to say, hey, I don't agree with what you're saying. I would like a second opinion. If they don't want those children to go home with parents because they are afraid, that I can understand. We do need to protect kids. People also need to remember the average abuser does not willingly take their children into a doctor. Every story on Parents Behind the Pinwheels, none of those were reported. None of those came from a neighbor, school, daycare. Every single one of those stories. Our parents walking in to a pediatrician or a hospital and saying, I have concerns for my baby. If a parent comes in with concerns, that child abuse pediatrician and the safety team, they need to take that right there alone. Let's run blood work. Let's run as many tests as we can and let's see what's going on. They also did a full workup on Aria, the three-year-old at the time. She came back with nothing. They've never had any run-in with the police, nothing criminal, no drug, no alcohol use. Why are you taking both kids because of these lesions? Why not look to see what's going on, especially if the parents are requesting it? It's their kids.
Sometimes it's hard for people to get in a parent's shoes and say, I think people have a misconception about parents. And often people see them as bad and all bad, not human beings. The number of children who are actually physically abused and sexually abused is tiny. This could easily happen to my grandson. I would never take my grandson to All Children's Hospital in St. Pete after what happened with Maya. I'll go out of state. I'll go anywhere, but there's no way. But it could happen to me. It could happen to you. It can happen to anybody. And I think when people start seeing that, I think that that's an opportunity for this thing to change. And I hope that maybe that a movement can start and people can start looking at foster care differently. Maybe the community will finally rise up and say, this is insanity, and this could happen to me, and something has to change. And that's the only way that it's going to change, because like I said, systems have no interest in changing. It's going to have to be the community that forces change.
And you need, unfortunately, representatives and legislators to back you up. You have to have that. And, you know, we've tried so hard, Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, we're reaching out to everybody to say, look at this. I volunteer now with You Are the Power. We have other families that we're advocating for. If you just take the time to look at this, there is no evidence of abuse for these families, but there is actual diagnosis of illnesses. That should be enough. Why are these parents going to trial for a crime that no one can even prove happened? The juvenile court system, family court system, A lot of them don't even hold the Constitution. They do whatever they want in that room. No cameras are allowed. They claim it's for privacy of the children. This is not true. There's no cameras. They keep everything hush-hush. They do whatever they want. When I was there in October, they made disgusting jokes between the DFACS and judge laughing while this family is being tormented and falling apart. And it's wrong, you guys. That's wrong. We do need the community to stand up. And what you said is true. There's a lot of people, they think if your child's in foster care, oh, well, they're probably on drugs. They don't love their kid the way I love my kid. It's a misconception. We're not understanding. And I wish we could get back to a place where we were just kind of that bridge to help biological parents. Now, I have three children who were adopted. So I understand adoption is necessary and I'm so thankful for it. But that's not why you jump into foster care. You're supposed to be in foster care to reunify.
And sometimes adoption is the unfortunate consequence of a parent not being able to finish a case plan. But yes, we should be getting more of these kids home than we are, for sure. Especially in these situations where parents are cooperative, willing, they have to be given a chance. What I have seen in dependency courtrooms has often been kind of like the wild, wild west. Like if there's a law, like everybody should have to follow it. And yes, and that's across the board. And if one person is held accountable, they all should be. That's just not what I've seen. It's just more of like the mood of the judge in the moment, or, you know, whatever way their wind is flowing that day. And they certainly seem to target certain parents. And they certainly seem to favor, like, I've had kids go home where I'm like, I know this is not safe. And then yes, I find out later that they're in a not safe situation that nobody can do anything about. And then I have parents who are doing absolutely everything and more and are exemplary. And like, I'm like, we should be taking this person and like throwing them on a statue and telling everybody, look, like people can do it. Like people can be successful when you give them the right support. And those are the ones that were standing on their back and like trying to hold them down when they're doing everything in their power.
That's crazy. We've experienced the same thing. That is the part where the community needs to jump in and we need to make real changes. We should not be making it this hard for parents to get their kids back when they're doing everything right. And we need to stop sending kids back to dangerous situations. It's so backwards.
That doesn't even mean that those parents don't get those kids back, but maybe we should have waited more than a couple of months. You know, maybe the change wasn't going to happen in a couple of months. What is the current status of the dependency case? You had said that it was changed back from termination to reunification.
It never actually was on termination. At the adjudication hearing, that's what DFACS requested initially, and that was denied. So thankfully, it's been reunification. They are getting visits separately, 2 days a week, each parent. Last week, both parents missed their visits because transportation and miscommunication between the department. Well, it's court ordered. So who's going to be in trouble for that? Nobody. That's another thing with oversight. Nobody did it. It's just miscommunication. So no one gets in trouble. Yet parents went extra days without seeing their kids. Right?
When Taki has only been seeing her kids for a few months now, right?
Since December. And, you know, the department even loved to throw that in her face at a following hearing to say, well, the kids aren't as connected to the mom as they are the dad. Okay, you took them from her for 7 months. They were connected to their father because he was the only one they were seeing. So they are on full reunification. Thankfully, the only thing holding us back is the criminal. Unfortunately, Matt and Taki both have criminal charges against them. It took Matt 7 months when this all happened before he actually got indicted through a grand jury at the same time as his wife. They're looking at the same charges, child abuse under family violence and aggravated battery. They have to go before trial, before a jury.
Well, and they can't even really acquire the medical documentation they need to fight those charges.
January 19th, they got the approval from the judge. You can now test your baby. We were so excited when we left. Guys, we're April 7th, and she now did just have a gene swab a few days ago. It took so long because parents, one, couldn't communicate. So mom and dad were each looking to find doctors, right? They have advocates like my family helping them. You are the power helping them. Attorneys doing what they can when they can. We have all these advocates helping. The department has to be the one to do it.
It just blows my mind how systems think when they take kids, they're our kids now.
They own them.
And they don't ever treat families like these are still your children. These are your children. When parents get their children removed, they have rights. In Florida, parents have rights, but no one cares.
They don't uphold that.
Just because you're going into the courtroom and because an attorney's sitting beside you does not mean justice is occurring.
Especially if you have the court-appointed attorney who does not have time for your case.
Have you guys experienced problems with guardian ad litems or child attorneys? Because that's been really heartbreaking to see in this situation. They do have a CASA and they do have an attorney. I am so disappointed.
In certain situations, it's like they're all working together.
In a lot of situations, they're all working together. In certain courtrooms, they meet up before the parent is allowed in the courtroom. They all meet up and decide what's going to happen during the hearing. And then the parent is allowed in. And I'm like, how is this legal? They're hanging out with the judge and the case manager and the guardian ad litem.
Hang out and make jokes. It's like disgusting.
The most awakening moment for me was when I walked into court with this mom, and she'd always told me every time I go in there, they look at me like I'm trash. And I kept telling her, I'm like, that's in your head. I'm like, because I had never seen anybody look at a parent like they were trash before. I didn't say that's in your head. I'm like, you probably think they're looking at you because you feel nervous to go in there. But I promise you, nobody feels that way about you. I was trying to like build her up and help her feel more comfortable about being nervous about going to court. One day I went, I picked her up and brought her to court. And I walked up the elevator with her and we walked out into the hallway. One of her children's attorney ad litem was the first person to walk past. And she looked over and before she came by, she looked at me and she goes, that's my child's attorney. And I go, oh, okay. And she goes, hi, I'm child's mom. And the woman looked at her in such a way that tears immediately sprang to my eyes and I got choked up and I could not believe. Now, this is not a mom who does whatever she wants, doesn't show up for anything. This is a mom that shows up for every single thing that she's supposed to for her kids. They tell her to go walk 5 feet that way. She'll walk 10 feet that way. What else can I do? What else can I do? Are there additional classes I could take? That's who we're talking about here. And for this mom to be looked at in this way by this child's attorney, I'm like, this is the mom of your client. Like how she didn't even respond with words. She looked at her in such a way that I felt like someone had punched me and it wasn't even me. And then the guardian ad litem showed up and they're all like whispering in the corner and talking to each other. And the case manager, they're all sitting there talking. And I was blown away at how real her perspective was because that was how they were treating her. Now, I don't feel like they treat every parent like that, but I feel like there are certain cases.
No, probably more than not.
Especially, I guess, in bigger cities, because where we're from in our rural area, going to the courthouse here, I didn't really see that, to be honest. The judge was wonderful. He treated everybody with respect and always asked foster parents if they would like to speak. It was always sad, right? Like court's sad usually, but it was always done with respect and kindness to everybody. But when you walk into juvenile court hearing in Forsyth County, I'm so sad. But, you know, working with these other families that we're advocating for, they're in different counties. You've got one right on the Florida-Georgia line in Camden County. And when they describe the judge and the defects attorney to me, I'm like, God, it sounds like the exact same people. So we have a problem. Everybody who tunes me out and is tired of me talking about it, you would not be tired if this was happening to you. I know people in my community, on my Facebook page, they're tired of hearing me, seeing me post things. You do not understand. These are these people's lives. This is their everything. This is literally the reason they live and breathe is their children. And we are destroying family units. Some of the people destroying, they're having a good time doing it and they're getting paid good money for it. And it's disgusting. And until we make some of those changes, I'm not going to stop talking about it. And I don't care if it bothers people, because if it was my children, I would hope to God somebody out there is as loudmouthed as me. The reason I do the interviews is because their attorneys tell them, with their criminal charges, you need to be mindful of what you say, right? You're not allowed to make interviews. And for some of them, they're actually told DFACS is so vindictive, you need to be quiet. Yeah. They will make your life a living hell. And I'm like, they've already taken their kids. They're going to make it harder on you to get your kids back. That should not be happening.
In all of these abuse of power stories, it seems like an initial mistake is made, maybe by one person, maybe by multiple people. When anybody confronts that mistake and says, hey, I don't think this is true, whether it's the parent or an advocate or some other person, instead of anybody in the system or these child abuse pediatricians ever saying, hey, let's double look at this. Let's see if we made a mistake and fix it. What I've seen is they then double down. Yes. And then instead of you just having a mistake, you have people lying to cover things up. You have people manipulating things. I think I had heard that Tucky wasn't able to get her child's medical records. How do you expect her to defend against these accusations when she can't have her own child's medical records? So the things that are done after the initial mistake is made often is way worse than the initial mistake. And it's just because they're covering it up. Some of these things are illegal.
They're working 10 times more to cover this up and getting more evil. And that's the word I use. And I use that word because that's what it is. It's evil. What they're doing is wrong. How are you supposed to win something and prove your innocence with something that didn't even happen? How do you prove a negative? How do you prove what didn't happen? All they want to do is prove what could be going on with their baby girl by getting testing done.
If these doctors or caseworkers were to say, you know what, you're right, we need to do some more testing, maybe a mistake was made, what bad would happen to them? They probably wouldn't even lose their job. But the consequence of them continuing to cover up is the destruction of a family. And not just one family, it's happening all over the country.
If you want to help the Hernandez family and other families experiencing abuse of power in Georgia, please contact Governor Kemp's office at 404-656-1776 and ask him to meet with the Hernandez family or message us on TikTok for more ways to help.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you subscribe and follow us on social. We hope that you join us again next time and keep on fostering the future.